Hi, everybody. It's Joel Whitaker, editor of Kane's Beverage News Daily, and we are delighted to have with us today Jason Barrett, who is the proprietor of Black Button Distillery up in Rochester, New York. He's the president and founder. It is a Rochester-based farm distillery, and we want to talk to him a little bit about his background and also how they're getting through the COVID virus and what impact the Craft Beverage Modernization and Tax Reform Act may have on his business in terms of if it gets passed or if it doesn't get passed. So, Jason, it's good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Excellent. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about your background? Where are you from? How did you get started? What's this about being a farm distillery and all that sort of good stuff?
Yeah, so I am actually originally from Rochester, New York. I was born and raised here, moved away for college and landed in Washington, D.C., where I was an accountant. And I was a traveling accountant. I worked kind of a half a day in each of these businesses, helping keep their books in line. And about 3 years in, I ended up with a distillery as a client. And I had been a home brewer for many years at that point. Loved making beer with my friends in my kitchen, and realized that my love of making beer and my understanding of business, I might actually be able to make a living making whiskey. So I did the perfectly reasonable thing and quit my safe, comfortable job, sold my house, sold pretty much everything I owned, cleared out my 401k, moved into my parents' basement, bought a still, and set about to make whiskey for a living. And that was 8 years ago. At this point, we have 63 employees. We distribute to 14 states. We export to Japan. And in a normal year, we'll make right around 100,000 bottles of liquor.
That sounds pretty impressive. It certainly sounds like your bet, if you will, turned out to be a successful bet.
It has worked out, and my folks are way less nervous than they were when I showed up with that U-Haul. and they were putting me up for a while.
Yeah, as a parent, I fully appreciate that. Whenever your child goes off and does something that's not totally corporately safe, you start to worry, even though we all know deep in our hearts that corporate America is no longer safe. You know, companies can be overloaded with debt and go out of business, or otherwise have to go through massive reorganizations. You as an accountant understand this better than I do, on and on and on. There really is nothing safe, but there are some things that we think are safe. And if you're old enough, you remember back when they were pretty safe. So, I appreciate your parents' nervousness. That's good. So
they were always very supportive. But once we turned the corner and it did start to look like this was a good idea, they did share with me some of their earlier concerns that I appreciate that they didn't share at the time.
I was going to say, good for your parents not sharing that, because that sort of thing could just be a morale killer, if you will. So I'm glad they didn't. That was good on their part. So you've been doing this for 8 years, right?
Yes, we have.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about the business. Where's your distillery? Do you have a tasting room? How are your employees split, and how are you getting through the COVID virus?
So we are an urban farm distillery, and what we decided 8 years ago was that it was easier to bring the farm product to the people than the people out to the country to see the farm product. So we work with a farm 45 minutes south of our facility. They grow all of our grain. The barley is malted locally at a local malt house. We work with a dairy about 45 minutes west of us for all of our cream needs for our bourbon cream, and then two cider orchards for the fruit-based products that we make. So our goal is really to take upstate New York agricultural products and turn them into world-class spirits. Because I know when folks think of New York, they think of Brooklyn, they think of Broadway, but up here, 6 hours north of the city, we're farm country, and we grow great crops, and we've got really unique weather that lends to really unique flavor profiles of those crops and the whiskey. and being interested in the local food movement and different whiskey was what got me really passionate about this. So when I quit my job, I went to 5 distilling schools, apprenticed at a couple places before moving home to do all of this. We have 27,000 square feet of production space where we make our products as well as a few contract clients' products. You know, it's 3 stills, 8 fermenters, and a big mash tun, and all the appropriate, supporting equipment. You know, there's about 10 folks in production, another 10 in the office, and then 15 sales reps that help us move everything along. We're a bit unique in many ways, but in New York, we're actually able to act as our own distributor. So our sales reps actually call on liquor stores and bars and restaurants directly, only selling Black Button products. That gives them a lot of time, attention, focus, and we're able to build really strong relationships with those stores. So that's been absolutely critical this year as we've moved through the pandemic. In our outer market, we work with generally, you know, tier one distributors in each market, whether that be Marganetti and Opici here in the Northeast or RNDC as we move into the Southeast and the West. We found those folks to be great partners, but one has to always keep in mind that they have thousands of products, some of which directly compete with Black Button on price and quality. So it's really on us to get the brand moving and our team that manages them. You know, it's a much more long-term planning, you know, annual sales goals rather than our New York team's very, you know, living in the moment, dealing with this month's orders. So we do almost everything in-house. We're a very vertically integrated company. We spec the crops that go into the ground. We pay for them at time of seed. We take financial responsibility for that field with our farmer. We dictate how it gets malted at the malt house and how the barrels get charred, because we're always looking and researching how to make the products a little bit better. And we do a lot of work with some of the local universities on, you know, how to test our products and how we might change things in our system, because even things as simple as the temperature that we ferment at can derive different components, you know, different flavor components in the end product. So we're always tweaking, looking to get a little bit better.
Well, that's absolutely terrific. And I'm glad that you're vertically integrated, because I think that that is, in fact, the best business model for most companies. I mean, I know that the theory for the last 30 years has been that you want to outsource everything and do nothing except grand planning. But I don't think that works. I think that you really do need to have that vertical integration. I think it helps to have the people that are making the stuff available to the people that are planning it, so that if something needs to be tweaked, they can tweak it right away. And, you know, I don't think we should ever ignore the possibility of the happy accident that results in some sort of a new breakthrough. We had that, you know, that's the famous story about the 3M Post-it notes. That was no great corporate planning. It was just purely an accident. And lo and behold, that's become a very valuable business to them. So I'm glad you're doing that. And tell us about
and
your
ironically,
taste.
Ironically, our best seller has a similar accidental birth story. So my father is an engineer, and mechanical engineer. He's a very literal man. Mm-hmm. If you were to ask him, does he know what time it is, he would say yes and think nothing of the fact that you wanted to know what time it is. And he retired a few years after I got started, and he would come into the tasting room and work behind the bar on like a Tuesday or a Wednesday when we weren't particularly busy. But he'd do some tastings and kind of putter around. And people would come in and they'd say, you know, so what do you like to drink? And his answer was either Chardonnay or Bailey's. And I kept trying to impress upon him that they meant, what do you like to drink that we make here? But they're not actually trying to get to know you. They are looking for recommendations. But unfortunately, being as engineer-focused as he is, we weren't ever able to overcome that. So one time during a discussion about that problem, he said, well, why don't you make something like Bailey's? then I could tell them I like drinking yours better. And I laughed and said, I have no idea where we would even start with that. A few weeks later, I'm at a Farm Bureau meeting, because we're very involved in the farm politics here in Western New York. And a guy comes up to me and says, I just bought a machine from Europe, and I'm told that I can mix whiskey in it and make something kind of like Bailey. So lo and behold, we went, saw his machine. A few weeks later, we're mixing up a batch of bourbon cream in the back of his dairy, and it tasted pretty good. So we made 1,000 bottles for Christmas that year, figuring it would be a nice little holiday thing. You know, we'd make 1,000 or 2,000 bottles each year. It'd be a fun little side project. Well, the first 1,000 sold out in a week, and the next batch sold out in 2. And pretty quickly, we were making it 25,000 bottles at a time instead of 1,000, and it's still probably the product we're best known for. All because my father is so literal that when asked what he likes to drink, he couldn't name one of our products. So it was a very happy accident. It was nowhere in the original business plan, but it fit with all of our goals of you know, elevating New York agricultural products and using locally sourced ingredients. So it worked. Now we make a lot of it.
Great. Do you have any idea whether it makes a difference to use New York products? And I know the obvious answer you're going to give me is, of course it does, but I'm really looking for a little bit beyond that, whether it makes a difference to use New York ingredients, or could you get your wheat or rye or whatever from Kansas and have it shipped in rail cars?
I mean, I think there's a couple of things that contribute to the differences. One is we have very unique weather up here. We get like 7 feet of snow, which most people would find very intolerable. End of Lake Erie.
That is why I declined a job offer from Democrat and Chronicle many, many years ago, because I knew you got a lot of snow. I didn't know it was seven feet, but, you know, that's why.
Many people find it intolerable. But it leads us to a very deep aquifer under the ground where the glaciers came through here a few million years ago, so we have a very thick topsoil. And then during the summer, we get a significant amount of rain while also getting a significant amount of sun. But a shorter growing season than most. But the other big thing about using local products is the ability to work directly with the farmer, where we can say we would like to have grain, our soft winter wheat. We'd like to plant it in the south-facing fields that slope down towards the lake. We'd like to plant it a little late so that the ground is a little drier. We can work with him on all of these details that allow us to really focus on the quality. So in theory, could you have that same focus with a farmer in Kansas? Possibly. But it would be harder to do because I would have to travel to Kansas each time we want to talk about it. Whereas the farmer and I regularly walk the fields that we use to grow these grains. And it's that learning loop, that feedback loop, that helps us develop ever better products. And then the whiskey aging up here is really unique. I mean, we went 23 days last year without getting above 0 degrees in January. And it is so dry and it is so cold. And what's interesting about whiskey in barrels at those temperatures is that the really volatile compounds, the methanol, the acetone, the things that give you that bite in the back of your throat, those are the smallest molecules, and they're going to evaporate first. So when they do, we get an incredibly smooth whiskey at an incredibly young age. Now, unfortunately, our Angel share is massive, 22% loss in 2 years. Versus about a 4% loss in Kentucky. So we're losing 11% of that whiskey every year, but we're getting then a dramatically expanded flavor profile very quickly. We also have pretty aggressive temperature swings. 30 to 40 degrees in a day is not uncommon up here. So what would take weeks of maturation in Kentucky or years in Scotland happens here sometimes each day. We have temperature and humidity sensors throughout our warehouse, and our main warehouse sees a 30 degree temperature swing most days, and 110-degree temperature swing across the course of the year.
That's pretty
a massive amount of maturation.
Yeah, that is pretty awesome, and I can see how that would make a difference. So you've just made a great case for people buying your product or other New York State products, and you gave me yet another reason why I did not to take that job at the Democrat and Chronicle when you said, how many days was it, 46 straight days below zero or something like 20, that?
23 straight days without getting above zero.
Well, I
have found that very few people move here. If you're born here, you're very comfortable with it, and the quality of life in Western New York is fantastic. But few people that weren't raised here are going to stand for the weather problems we have. But it's interesting. I think it gives us unique whiskey, and I think that's what consumers are so interested in, that whiskey from Alaska and whiskey from California and whiskey from New York are going to be inherently different than Kentucky whiskey, and therefore open up new opportunities to taste new things.
Sure. And the public does seem to be very interested in having new experiences, rotating around. So I think I'm glad to hear that that's working for you. Now, tell me a little bit about your survival through the COVID thing. I mean, for instance, did you find it necessary? I'm sure you had to close your tasting room, at least for a while.
Yeah.
Did you have to get a Paycheck Protection Program loan or anything, or were you able to ride through it without doing that? Or talk to us about how you survived through this period, because there are so many guys who've had to go out of business because they just, couldn't make it.
So our story is a little strange. The New York State was hit very hard, very early by the pandemic, and thus we had restrictions earlier than most of the rest of the country. And so when the governor called on us to voluntarily close, we started to put the plant into a shutdown mode for fear that the fermenters would go rogue if we were unable to tend to them. And as we were putting the plant into shutdown and getting ready to furlough everyone, it was really very emotional, because a lot of our employees do live paycheck to paycheck. And don't have deep reserves, and not knowing when we would be coming back to work was causing a great deal of stress, as well as the fact that, it was becoming clear that we were not well positioned as a state to manage this. So before we had actually finished the shutdown, we got a hold of the FDA recipe for ethanol-based hand sanitizer. And through some connections, I talked to a local hospital group and said, hey, I think I have everything necessary to make about 5,000 bottles of hand sanitizer. Would that be helpful? And they said, not only would that be helpful, can you make 10,000 more? Okay, we can try. So we delivered 5,000 bottles to Rochester Regional Health 3 days later, made from vodka that was destined to become gin, but now destined to be hand sanitizer. And as the word started to spread through the hospital community that we had the ability to make hand sanitizer, the calls just started pouring in. At one point, we actually had to hire additional people to help deal with the phone calls and emails, because they topped out at 1,200 emails per day.
Oh, my goodness.
Which we were just not expecting. So it became clear that there was a massive need, that we were uniquely positioned to help. And so we started calling in all the favors that we've accumulated over the last 8 years, and we took the plant to 11. Our assistant distillers became shift captains. We split the team in two. So we had two 10-hour shifts, 6 days a week, running the distillery now 120 hours a week. We borrowed bottling lines from wineries and had two more flown in from Texas and had nowhere to put them, so we just installed them under tarps in the parking lot. And by the time that the world had started to calm down, by the end of July, we had made 400,000 bottles of hand sanitizer. And these were full-size, 24-ounce, 300 hand washes in a bottle. So where we made 100,000 bottles of liquor in all of 2019, we made in 52 weeks, we made 400,000 bottles of hand sanitizer in 14 weeks. And It was really crazy, but it kept everybody working. I mean, we had bartenders serving as bottlers. We had marketing assistants. packing cases. We had, you know, people's relatives that were had been laid off. You know, there was no time to do formal hiring. So somebody would say, "Hey, my brother just got furloughed. Great, can he start tomorrow? We'll put him on payroll and let's get going." So we rapidly expanded to meet that demand throughout Western New York. We shipped down to the Javits Hospital in New York City. We shipped pallets to Detroit and Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and, you know, Wisconsin. And it was all by word of mouth. I mean, there was no advertising. We were just trying to keep up with this dramatic demand. And as fast as that came up, it all disappeared. July 28th, we got our last order of hand sanitizer, and the world just didn't need ethanol-based hand sanitizer anymore. I think Purell had caught up and some of the initial wave of panic had subsided, and we rolled back our bottling lines and gave back the ones to the wineries and looked around the warehouse and realized that we had almost no liquor left. We had made no liquor in 14 weeks, and our sales guys had still been calling on the liquor stores. And so August and September and even to today, we're still running our plant like crazy trying to catch up. Now, the unfortunate part, several of our seasonal items had to be passed over this year. There just wasn't time to make them for when they should have been released. We've lost almost all of our restaurant accounts. We lost our Buffalo tasting room. We had to close that completely. It was an offsite tasting room, and our Rochester tasting room is operating at about 25% capacity. Mm-hmm. Combine that with the fact that a significant number of our bartenders this is their second job. They work part-time for us and full-time for someone else. As they would sometimes be laid off or furloughed from their full-time job, they would often have to resign from the part-time job in order to qualify for, you know, unemployment and various forms of government assistance. So we started the year with 105 employees. We stand today with 63, and most of those were not separations of our choosing. But it's a much smaller team. We're doing more with less, and, you know, we're just trying to keep our head above water. Right now, we stand pretty well even with where we were last year, which we're pretty excited about. We've been able to make up for the loss of the bars and restaurants, but nothing can really make up for the loss of the tasting room revenue, which is, although a small part of our business, the most profitable. And so even though the volume has stayed fairly consistent for us, it's going to be a tough winter, especially as the snow starts to roll in. We've been doing a lot of parking lot parties and people sitting outside. And even though we've got some propane heaters and Western New Yorkers are pretty hardy, we're not expecting that to last much more than a few more weeks, at which point, with the tasting room closed, it will be a very long, hard winter.
Yeah, it sounds like it certainly will, and I'm sorry about that, and I hope that the advent of the vaccines, which appear to be getting closer by the day, will help you get out of this quicker than it would otherwise, because I think that, you know, there's no question that that bars, restaurants, and producers that depend upon tasting rooms have had a absolutely horrible, horrible time all year. So I'm glad that you're at least it sounds like you're in relatively good shape, which probably means as an accountant you did not load yourself up with too much debt as you expanded the business.
We've been very careful that all the debt is well structured with the Small Business Administration, and we've been able to maintain all of that. We also, you know, distilleries in some ways are lucky compared to wineries and breweries. We're making product for many years ahead oftentimes. So you can downshift your cash spend quickly. The problem is you then won't have as much whiskey to sell 4 to 6 years from now. So
right,
we will have to pay that piper someday, but we'll still be here to pay that piper. And that's the critical piece. So yeah, we've been able to keep the cash inflows and outflows somewhat balanced, but it unfortunately means laying down only about 25% of the whiskey we wanted to. And
right,
someday that will be a problem. but I'll deal with that at that point. We do feel like we're doing better than most. We've got great friends in the restaurant industry that are really struggling, and anytime we can do things that can help them, we're always looking to do that. But it's just been a tough year on everybody.
Right. And now with the as you head into this, what's going to be for you a very hard winter, not just because of the virus in terms of illnesses, but, you know, just as you say, it's going to become not practical to do your parking lot parties and so on. You got the Craft Beverage Modernization and Tax Reform Act about to expire. So talk to us a little bit about that. Tell us why you care, although I think we all have a pretty good idea after hearing that story. But go ahead and tell us why you care, and if you want to, what, if anything, you're doing to hopefully get it passed, get the renewal passed.
Yeah, so the 2020, the hits just keep on coming. The pending expiration of the Craft Beverage Modernization Act, a 400% increase in our federal excise taxes. For a distillery of our size, it's a $250,000 swing. And having done this now for 8 years, I can tell you liquors, you know, especially at our scale, is not particularly a profitable endeavor. You know, by the time you cut in the distributor and you cut in the retailer and you pay for the marketing and you pay for the people and you're trying to you know, again, lay down more whiskey to make for 6 years from now, there's not a lot of cash left. And that's what we signed up for. I know that. But it was a huge, huge help 3 years ago when that got passed. It allowed us to hire additional people. It allowed us to invest more in marketing. And, you know, we're now at a point where we really don't want to be letting those people go. So we have to find that money from other places. And it comes from the marketing budget. It comes from the whiskey budget. It comes by deferring maintenance on the machine a little longer than you'd like to. But it's a massive swing that basically makes it, even without COVID, it would probably have made it impossible for us to be profitable in 2021. And now with COVID and the loss of our most profitable revenue channels, I mean, we're probably going to have the worst year we've had in 8 years, the majority of that being driven by this tax increase. And I understand that the federal government is also short on cash and they need to raise it in certain places. I just would hope that the small distillers, many of whom stepped up across the country to help when help was needed, aren't where they decide to balance that budget, because the interesting thing at our size, pretty much every dollar we save goes back into either another barrel or another hour of somebody working or more grain bought or more ads bought. I mean, it is a direct, you know, the money comes in and the money goes right back out. And so this increase will be felt locally, you know, not just by our employees, but by our farmers, by our vendors. And, you know, it's a big hit. Especially, again, as the business is shifting more to the lower margin distributor items. I mean, our federal excise taxes are 10 times what we hope to make in profit on that bottle. So a 400% increase on that, you know, I've either got to go change my prices, which now make me less competitive against the international players, or I've got to eat it and basically agree to lose money on every bottle till we can get it resolved. And that's pretty much the definition of a rock and a hard place. Because I don't know that people realize that if we raise our prices by $2 or $3, the distributor has to raise their prices by $4 or $5, which causes the store to raise their price by $6 to $8. So now all of a sudden that what used to be a $30 bottle of gin is now a $38 bottle of gin. And the market of people that are buying a $38 bottle of gin is about 10% of those buying a $30 bottle of gin. So we really are kind of damned if we do and damned if we don't, because by raising our prices, we're likely to lose 90% of our volume. And you can't make up, you can't, you know, I've been an accountant long enough to know you can't turn a profit by making it up on volume if you're losing money on every bottle.
Right, because at that point, you're losing more money than...
Yes, actually, as it ticks up speed, it gets worse and worse. Now, our hope, we've been working very closely with DISCUS, the American Craft Spirits Association, the New York Distilling Guild, as well as our local representatives, both in the Senate and in the House. Because what's crazy to me about the Craft Beverage Modernization Act, we have more than 50% of both the House and the Senate as co-sponsors. If the bill was put forward tomorrow as an independent bill, it would pass with overwhelming bipartisan support. But Congress apparently doesn't believe in passing individual tax bills, but rather larger omnibus bills. And with none of those in sight, we just have no way to get our proposal to a vote. So it's particularly disheartening to know that Congress actually does see our point. And we have more co-sponsors than would even be needed to pass it by a wide margin. And yet we will probably never get the conversation in a hearing room where the bill will be brought to the floor. And with no method of going forward, we're just battening down the hatches, getting ready for this.
Which must be very concerning to you as you contemplate that. And meanwhile, of course, you're hoping that at the end of the day, before the year's out, they'll do one of those massive bills, and if nothing else, extend it for another couple of years, which seems to be the pattern in this town that we operate from.
Yeah, it's interesting that certainly a real win is a permanent or 10-year extension, but it's amazing how you'll now will settle for one just to kick the can down the road and let it be a problem for another year. I have a number of friends that joke that one of the reasons you need to make a lot of whiskey when you're in this business is because you need a lot of whiskey to get through being in this business. So we luckily have some whiskey to console us in the evenings when the going gets tough.
that's a great quote. I think it's probably very true too. Well, that's terrific. So I know you're hoping that this all gets wrapped up quickly, and that in fact the bill does get passed or worked into another bill. And you're absolutely right. That's what they like to do in Washington. They like to put it in as I think, frankly, as a sweetener to get people to vote for something they really don't want to vote for. And it would be nice if they would just do, you know, single bills and push them through and get them taken care of. But that does not seem to be the way they've worked for the last 20 or 30 years anyway. So, you know, good luck on that. Before we wrap up, why don't you take a moment and tell us about your biggest lesson learned in case somebody is listening to this and decides they want to follow your footsteps. Biggest lesson learned, and then I want you to contrast that with the biggest I don't want to say mistake you've made, but the biggest non-positive lesson you've learned. So one positive lesson, one non-positive lesson.
Ben.
Oh. Happy to do it. So the bright spot, I guess, was really watching our team react to this just incredible change in business as we ramped up, sales, marketing, there wasn't actually a ton of marketing, I guess, to do, but sales, accounting, and production to meet this this need with the hand sanitizer. And the only way that really worked was that we have a very distributed, kind of decentralized decision-making process at Black Button. The department heads and even the individual employees are really empowered, to make good calls and good decisions on their own. And that if they, and certainly they can consult with folks as it moves up the chain of command, but, if we send someone out with a task, we really want them to make the individual decisions and come back with it done. And that was the only way we could expand a team effort like this, to go from, 1,000 bottles a day to at one point 40,000 bottles a week. It just required an immense amount of sorting and shipping, and and you've got salespeople acting as shipping agents, and there's just no time to train them on how to do that. They just have to figure it out. And we've got a really great culture of smart, hardworking people that are determined that they can do it. And that's really the only way we were able to make those changes. And it's what makes us successful day in and day out. You know, I can't have sales reps calling me or the sales manager after every meeting to go over what they can do for the client. They need to know what their limits are, and they need to be able to make those calls in the meeting with the customer to move the ball forward. And that takes a really unique set of people. Recruiting and company culture, I don't think I realized how important those things were when I started the business. And it's now something I spend a lot of time working on and thinking about and trying to improve, because our employees are our greatest asset. The biggest mistake I've ever made was one that I should have seen coming, and luckily was something we have finally been able to extract ourselves from. But this business is heavily dominated by the distributors. They are probably the most powerful of the three tiers of the three-tier system. And in the early days, we were just so excited that people wanted to distribute our products that we signed distribution agreements that were very disadvantageous to us. Big buyout clauses, no performance requirement. And that really hurt our growth in some of those areas where we aligned with the wrong people. And luckily, we've extracted ourselves from all of those. Our distribution network now is top rate. People that are really working to help us, drive our brand in their market. But it cost me a couple $100,000 and several years of lost growth opportunity to rectify that. So I encourage anyone in this industry, if you're signing a distribution contract, you need a lawyer that has done these before for our industry, not your family attorney that draws up wills and sells houses. You need a liquor attorney to look over those distribution contracts, because you'd be amazed what can be in them that you might not originally realize. And I'm just thankful that we got out of them, because it would have continued to stymie our growth had we not been able to rectify, basically buy our way out. So, you live, you learn.
So those are two very great lessons. And so often we do hear people blithely talk about our employees are our most valuable asset. But certainly in your case, they really were, because they've been able to spin on a dime to move over and to actually help you hire more people to get through the hand sanitizer era. And now with a smaller workforce, still able to produce the product and get it out and get it distributed. So, that's absolutely fabulous. And I think your point about the having the right attorney is absolutely critical too. And I've never heard somebody explain it as well as you did. So you can count on me. I will make sure that explanation gets repeated many times in the future. Jason Barrett, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you about your wonderful little farm distillery, Black Button Distilling, and up there in Rochester, New York. Good luck on your winters. I'm sure you're used to them and get through them just fine, but good luck, and we will talk to you soon in the future. So have a very great day, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
Right.